This is 4:55 on Wednesday, November 30th.
All right.
So, unfortunately, for some reason, there wasn't even an audio recording for Monday. So, sorry. Thought there was, but when I left here, there wasn't. So
it goes. I am recording this morning. Yes, you see the little thing down in the left-hand corner saying it's recording, so that's good. Schedule, we're going to talk about security primarily for the next five lectures. But on Monday, we will talk about any issues arising in the proxy assignment. So be, you know, far enough along to know what the issues are by then, to make it as helpful as possible. But I'm not going to spend the whole period on that, but rather just deal with any questions. I'm sorry I did not get Chapter 5 returned. I still have it. I will do that today. And any questions? Logistics? Problems with proxies? No? Okay. So we're going to start now the chapter on security. And let's see. Go to this mode. And I think the stated goals here on the slide are a bit lofty for what we're actually going to do and what the chapter itself accomplishes. I think what is accomplished in this section is that we get some discussion of the mechanisms of security, and we get some discussion of the uses of those mechanisms. But I would say that ultimately this is not a security class, and you should not go out of here thinking you know very much about security. It's a complicated subject, and it's complicated not only in the algorithms that are used, but also in the way that those algorithms are deployed. It's very easy to have a good algorithm and mess up its deployment. So, for example, if you've read anything about the breaking of the Enigma cipher, too, Alan Turing, a name that you should know, was instrumental in that. And the reason it was able to be broken was not because it was fundamentally weak, although it certainly had some weaknesses, but rather because the way they used it actually produced little hints about what was going on. And Turing was able to use his computers that he built at Bletchley Park to exploit those little hints and turn them into bigger and bigger hints with a lot of computation until ultimately they were able to break the cipher. And so the caution is that unless you're an expert in this, you need to find an expert. If you're ever asked, if you're ever asked to do anything that involves sort of novel security approaches, standard security approaches, well, that's where you start. You start using the standards. You start using them in standard ways. But then you also monitor the conversation going on out in the world to find out when those standard ways and those standards have been compromised. And we're going to see somewhere later in this chapter that a recommendation that is made on the slides is in fact not a good recommendation at all anymore, because the world has changed. People have learned things, and they don't do that anymore. Okay, so we're going to talk about cryptography itself, the cryptographic algorithms, the so-called cryptographic hashing algorithms, We're not going to go into detail about any of them. I will illustrate how the RSA public key crypto system works. I think there's a problem in the assignment about that has you sort of work through an example of that. We won't do it in the kind of with the actual kinds of numbers that you would really use, but that's on. Okay, so there's the cryptography and its many uses. Then we're going to talk about something that I consider far more challenging, actually, than cryptography at this stage of the world, and that is authentication. The reason it's more challenging is because even though we use the same algorithms often that we use for cryptography in doing authentication, there's this nasty problem associated with authentication, which is that people are not digital computers. And therefore, people cannot sort of participate in all of those nice algorithms that use digital computation to do authentication. So, if somehow I were an entity that had a great big number associated with me that I could do sort of in my head computations on, then perhaps it would be possible for other people to authenticate me digitally. Right? But I'm not. And so we end up with ways of associating that digital world with the biological world. And those mechanisms themselves can be flawed and have issues with them. So it gets really complicated to say, who am I digitally? And we'll talk about that before then. Then there's the problem of ensuring, first of all, there's a problem of figuring out just who I am. Then there's the problem that somebody that I'm interacting with has of figuring out whether the messages that they're receiving really come from me or not. And that's, once we figured out the first problem, the second one is not so hard, but we'll go over some of those mechanisms that are available for doing that. And then we will talk about security in practice. The book talks about firewalls and intrusion detection systems. I want to talk some more about security in a broader systems context than just that. There's some new work going on that is pretty exciting, I think, for moving away from a worldview in which the only thing we can do is layer on more and more mechanisms and sort of instead try to figure out more what it is we're trying to do and do that thing with respect to security. So we'll say more about that at the end. Okay, any questions about this? Let's see over here. So, somehow somebody got really clever about 30 years ago and realized that the three main properties that we're interested in with respect to security are confidentiality, integrity, and availability. All right. Now, availability is not up here, but what do those three things tell? Those initials. Confidentiality, integrity, and availability. CIA. All right, so just remember if you're talking about security, you're talking about the CIA. Okay? And in different realms, those properties have different weightings associated with them. In the area where I do research associated with monitoring and control of the power grid, turns out that availability and integrity are way more important than confidentiality in a lot of cases, because it's not so important whether somebody knows whether you're generating a certain amount of power. What's more important is that you know whether when the generator says I'm generating this amount of power, that's what it's really doing, if that message really came from the generator and it hasn't been tampered with, and that you can actually get that message, right? That's the availability side of things. So, So different weights on those in different contexts, but they do tend to be the important ones. Okay, so confidentiality is just what it says, that only the sender and receiver know what the message contains. Right? Nobody else can figure it out. Authentication is knowing who it is you're talking to. We talked about that. Integrity is making sure that the message that was sent was actually the one that was received. And availability is, of course, actually being able to get messages where they need to go. Okay, so it has become conventional in talking about these things in lectures to talk about Alice and Bob as the primary parties involved who are communicating with Trudy, the intruder, as the adversary. got that? okay, so people in this field do have something of a sense of humor. Okay, why Alice and Bob are lovers, I don't know. Okay, so our model is that Alice has something she wants to say to Bob, and vice versa. And they talk over a channel. We've talked about channels before. That is insecure. That is an intruder can sort of see what's happening on the channel. And our goal with our secure sender and secure receiver is to scramble things up in such a way that that Alice and Bob are nevertheless able to have private communications and authenticated communications. Trudy is somebody who can not only listen to the channel, she can put messages on the channel. I don't know if there's any significance in the intruder being female or not. That doesn't seem like it's relevant. So who are these parties? Well, certainly your web browser is likely to be something that wants to send messages that other people can't receive. What's the importance of authentication with respect to your web browser? Anybody? Why is authentication important in your web browser? Well, but can you sort of up level that a little bit? How about we just want to know who we're talking to? Yeah, right. that's the gist of the matter, right? That when you are doing a banking transaction, and putting in your password for interacting with the bank. You would sure like to be convinced that it's the bank you're talking to. Yeah.
The web browser would store the token to authenticate. So it gets the pass as well.
Say that again?
Your web browser will store a token that gets given to you to authenticate.
Oh, okay. So that's the other way around, right? Is that the party at the other end wants to know that it is you that is, you know. And you want them to know that, right? You don't want your bank to let other people use your bank account. Right? So depending, and this is where we'll get into some of these conversations about system level security, depending on what the requirements are, we may do things like, as suggested, have the web browser store something, a cookie usually, that allows it to automatically authenticate to the other party. Or we may not, right? You probably don't want your bank to do that. You probably want your bank to insist that you actually log in. For your Gmail account, well, it seems that at least Gmail thinks that it's okay for your web browser to remember that information and not force you to log in every time. But certainly your web browser is making sure that it's Google that it's talking to when it does that. Yeah?
So if you're So obviously you still need to give them, or somebody needs to, there needs to be communication between the sender and the receiver, and the key needs to be given. So I know some like web browsers have built in HTTPS, so you don't have to do that. How is that accomplished? Like for certain sites, it automatically is HTTPS, not the initial HTTP interface.
Okay. So it's important. The web service owner has decided it's important to only talk over HTTPS, right? So the way that works is that if you contact them on HTTP, they will issue a redirect to the HTTPS site, right? They won't proceed on HTTP. That's one of the things that's in the HTTP protocol, and you may well see that in your proxy at some point. If you see that in your proxy, what's going to happen is that the redirect is going to cause the browser to go to the HTTPS site. Your proxy will no longer be involved and won't see anything more after that. That's a good thing. Because if a proxy could see what was going on in an HTTPS connection, then it would essentially mean that it was broken, that it wasn't doing what it was supposed to do.
How does it get that initial certification? Mm-hmm. Like, you get, now you're saying, like,
oh, so
getting a key.
So how do we know? Yeah. So how do we get the key for talking to the HTTPS server? We'll get to that.
Okay.
Let's defer that because we want to talk about public key cryptography and certificates first.
Does the processor have to be marked as special for it to be used in the HTTPS?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And in fact, I don't think the browsers really support that. What happens is that, there's some good stories associated with this. 2 years ago, about 2 years ago, Lenovo, the company that sells many of our laptop computers, got in huge hot water because they had actually configured a set of what's called certificates in the machine in such a way that they could run a proxy server that could see everything that you were doing. And this was not a good thing. And worse of all, even worse, they had done this in such a way that anybody else could run a proxy server that could see everything you were doing, too. So, proxy servers for HTTPS are used. The only legitimate use of them that I would consider is that in a corporate network, where all of the machines are essentially the assets of the corporation and all of the interactions being done by the people there are the assets of the corporation, then it would be sort of ethically okay, from my perspective, to have a proxy server that was decrypting HTTPS. Even that's kind of iffy, but that's the only place that I can think of that's even approaching okay.
So how is caching done there for the sensibility?
Typically not.
It's not.
Right. You just, over HTTPS, you said security is more important than performance, so we'll go with security. Alright? Good questions. Keep them coming. Alright? So this can be very interactive. DNS servers? We talked about DNS, right? What is DNS? The name service, right? And if I look up a name and get the wrong answer, then my machine is being directed to the wrong site. That's an opportunity for somebody to do potentially nefarious things. So there's slow progress toward securing the DNS infrastructure so that when we ask the question, we have higher assurance that we're getting a correct answer, right? And that the actual databases being used by the DNS servers themselves are not being compromised. So that's important. Routers exchanging routing table updates. Yep, all good stuff. And different, each of these different use cases has a different approach to accomplishing security. So, our model, we model what attackers can do. And we say they can eavesdrop, which means that they can intercept, that was the arrow coming out of the channel to Trudy. They can inject messages from Trudy into the channel. In IP, an intruder can actually put any address, any source address it wants to, into a message, right? Doesn't mean that the guy who gets it can reply to them if they lie about that, but they can put any source address they want to into a message. Taking over a connection by sort of getting in the middle and sort of seeing everything that goes by, or taking over a connection by sort of having an ongoing TCP connection and sort of getting in the middle and then just getting the original guy out of the way and just being the new guy. And denial of service, of course, is doing things that keep people from doing what they intend to do by either overloading resources, blocking traffic, so on and so forth. I had a very interesting experience last night about impersonation. It didn't happen on the computer, it happened on the telephone. So, sitting at my computer, phone rings, pick it up, caller ID says Spectrum, and gives a phone number. And who I am. And they said, hi, this is Spectrum, and we'd like to talk with you about the services on your account. Could you confirm the last four of your social security number for me so that we can access your account? And I said, no way. Why? They called me. I have no idea who they are. Said, no way. Well, okay.
That's
good.
A good scam.
What?
That's a good scam. A lot of people.
it goes on. So she said, okay, well, we'd really like to talk to you about your services. There are other ways you can verify, like the account number or the PIN associated with the account or the phone number associated with the account, or, you know, just a whole bunch of things. I said, I'm not telling you any of those things. Not going to do it. Well, let me get my manager. So, pause, and a few seconds later, a guy comes on, and I explain, I try to explain that you're doing the world a huge disservice by calling up people and asking them to do this, because you're essentially training your customers to respond to such inquiries, and that's a bad thing. And I try to explain this to the manager. Oh no, we're not training our customers. Okay, so this goes on. My wife said my blood pressure was way too high because I was not happy at all about this. So we ended that. I didn't give them any of the information. They didn't seem too upset about it, but fine. There was never really any pressure to respond. It just wouldn't react to this theory that they were training their customers to do bad things. So I hung up, and then the phone rang, and I talked to somebody else for a while, and I said, you know, I need to call Spectrum. So I called Spectrum, and also known as Time Warner Cable. And there's no menu entry on the customer service number for reporting security incidents. So I just said billing, and went through to billing, and the guy asked me what phone number was associated with the account, and he was happy with that because it was the same as the one I was calling from. So all that was good, and I explained what had happened, and he said, well, we would never do that. We would never call you and ask you for that information. All right. So, here I am. I said, well, in that case, you have somebody who's very good at this attempting to fish your customers. And you better get on, because this is not good.
And there's a manager, too.
I know. Well, somebody who claims to be a manager.
Yeah.
Right? So, but it was all done. Yeah, people spoke really good English. Sometimes you get these things, and it's clear that they're coming from India or Africa or China, just from the accents of the people, their inability to form sort of English sentences with good grammar and so forth. Sometimes it's like, this was really, really good. So, question. Was it really a phishing attempt, or was it a marketing department at Spectrum trying to actually get me to evaluate my services and see if I really have no idea, because there are indications both ways. And I have no way to authenticate the people who called. The fact that caller ID says something means absolutely nothing, because anybody can fake. It's like faking IP addresses. Anybody can fake caller ID, right? But it isn't hard at all. So I don't know, but that's sort of what the world is like. And people do it over the phone. They do it in emails. Called phishing, phishing. Questions, comments? Anybody dealt with those?
I like how they wrote bad guys and also girls to be inclusive. How many bad people there are out there?
Okay.
You don't want to train you to think just guys.
Right. Right. That's probably a good thing. Right. But yeah. So if you're involved in a company that's doing this stuff, think about what you're training your customers to do by your security practices. WSU has taken, you get the network ID renewals, right? I just had to go through that. They've taken to not putting the link to the reset site in the message, but rather just putting the name is not a link, and telling you to type this into your browser. That's a better thing. Yeah.
What's your opinion on all the spam email that we get?
What's my opinion on all the spam email?
Is it prevented, or like?
It's very hard. They work hard. Okay. They catch a lot of it. But it's gotten worse again recently.
They
do catch a lot of it.
They catch you doing it, or like,
what?
Are they just shutting down the accounts, or are they actually catching you doing it?
Sometimes it comes from student accounts, which typically means that the student account has been compromised, or maybe not, right? Because it's possible in an email message. Think about how an email message works. Right? You have this from field, it's plain text. You can write anything you want to in there. So I believe what they do is, if you get messages like that purport to come from WSU addresses, you should forward them to the address abuse@wsu.edu. Just forward. Just, you don't have to say anything about it. Just forward it. And typically what happens is that a few hours later you get a message saying if it actually was sent by the WSU account, they will have shut down the account, changed the password, and that person is going to have to sort of read.
I'm just kind of curious, because I don't think like spam filter, like using like phase algorithm,
uh-huh.
Back in the phase, you know, where it's like the WSU address is not approved, it's just talking about certain like functionality, like changing passwords or going to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's really complicated. And even Bayes filters, but they do a lot of it. But some get through, and new techniques get invented to get around them.
That's true.
What was that?
Oh, he's just saying, well, like it's from a student, like an actual account.
Right. So we organizations tend not to use filters against their internal parties. So that's part of the reason here. But if people are faking the from address, then it's really coming from outside, and
yeah,
they should be doing better.
They don't even need to fake it. The university email system doesn't block email sent on behalf of somebody else. So I can send email on behalf of the president, and it will still go through.
And partly that's because there are legitimate uses for that functionality.
Right.
Right. So if you're going to control it, then you have to put in another whole layer of who is permitted to send on behalf of who else. That's more complicated than they've been willing to step up to do so far. And so the other thing that happens with this masquerading and makes things difficult is I have this problem with my family emails, in that spammers have taken to using my wife's email address for sending spam to me, right? Which means that I can't whitelist my wife's email address. And so when she sends email to me, it goes through the spam filters, and either it passes or doesn't, and some of them don't make it through. Yeah. That's a denial of service attack that's been accomplished by something else. Okay. So as we talk about this stuff, feel free to bring up examples like that. If something reminds you of something else, then let's... Part of the defense about this stuff is, you know, a population that is sensitive to these issues. It's not that a population that is sensitive to these issues can shut it down entirely, but a population that is sensitive to these issues might well make it insufficiently rewarding to carry out some of these attacks. Part of the problem now is that too many people will actually respond to attacks, phishing attacks, that makes it economically viable to continue doing that. If we could make it not economically viable to do these attacks, then people would stop doing them, for the most part. I mean, there would still be sort of high-value targets that would potentially get attacked, but ordinary citizens might not be to quite the extent of that. Okay. All right, let's talk about cryptography. And most of you have probably played with cryptography in some form at some point in your life with your secret decoder rings. And anybody played with secret decoder rings or disks or anything? Made those when you were a kid? Circle with alphabets are on the inside and outside, and turn the disk and fun stuff. Okay, so the idea is we start with some plain text, and part of the reason for going through this is not because it's new, but just because I want to introduce the notation that this set of authors uses to talk about this stuff. So we start with what's called a plain text message. That's a standard term, and these authors tend to use M for that message. Plain text means the message without any encryption applied to it. We apply an encryption algorithm and I don't like their notation for this particularly well, but think of K as the algorithm and A as the key, maybe. So we apply the encryption algorithm using key A to M to produce the ciphertext. So that's the next term. And the ciphertext is what goes over the channel. At the other end, Bob applies the algorithm using his key, and out comes the plain text. That's simple enough. Uh, We talk about different kinds of attacks on these encryption schemes. This is the part of this whole field where expertise is really, really needed. Right? Making up your own encryption schemes is really not a good idea. Good encryption schemes are done by people with lots of experience who then talk to other people with lots of experience and get the things sort of well vetted before they go into use. There are way too many instances of people using homegrown encryption schemes that are just junk, to put it bluntly, especially in areas of embedded systems. And by that I mean embedded in airplanes, embedded in cars, embedded in refrigerators. People seem to think that they can do better than the world has done. This is seldom the case. So, go with the standards for the schemes. What do people do against these attacks, against these schemes? Well, they may be able to only look at the ciphertext. They may be able to see the plain text and the ciphertext. They may even be able to choose some plain text and get the owner of the keys to encrypt it for them. That's called chosen plain text. It was this that was the primary source of the Enigma break. They didn't have very much plain text, very much known plain text, but they had a little bit, and the Germans used the ciphers over enough known plain text that they were able to get statistical evidence for what the keys were. Brute force search, search through all the keys, or just look at various statistical properties of the ciphertext itself. So, anybody play cryptograms in the Sunday newspaper? Have they ever done that?
Yeah?
So, that's a statistical analysis approach, right? That we know the frequency of occurrence of letters in English, and we use that to attack these simple substitution ciphers. Needless to say, simple substitution ciphers are not good ciphers for the modern age. Okay, so two big families of encryption or cryptography are so-called symmetric key cryptography and public or asymmetric cryptography. Symmetric just means that the two parties use the same key to do the encryption and the decryption. Right? So what does this mean? It means that in order to communicate with someone securely, you need to have a key that is known only to you and the receiver. That's the property of symmetric key. And the problem, of course, is how do we get that symmetric key shared between the two of us? So, of course, this is a 2,500-year-old field, and how have people done this? They have, let's see, don't remember the source of this story, but one of the stories is that at some point one commander tattooed the key on the scalp of his messenger, waited for his hair to grow out, and then sent him to the other party, who shaved his head and was able to read the key. So that's a pretty good one. locked briefcases chained to people's wrists. That was a popular way of doing this for some period of time. Anyway, it's a big problem, right? Because what you've got to do is guarantee that only the two parties know the key, and it's bad for the process if the messenger gets captured. It's even worse for the process if the messenger gets captured and then sent on his way, sort of not knowing that this happened, because then you actually use the key and the other party can read it. Okay? So an example of this is the secret decoder ring kind of thing, where we do substitution of letters for letters. The key is a permutation of the alphabet. You can get fancier, you can have multiple such substitution ciphers that cycle through them. Still junk. Right? These are just not interesting, except to illustrate the principle of how it works. In the late 1900s, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, a government agency, recognized that it was important that there be a way to conduct commerce using electronic messaging, and they came up with this standard called DES. It uses 56-bit keys. The process is such that nobody knows really of any attacks against it that are much better than a brute force attack. Unfortunately, as of now 20 plus years later, brute force attacks against this are feasible computationally, because it's possible to assemble enough computing resources to do a brute force attack for not very much money. And so DES is no longer considered an adequate encryption standard. There are replacements for it. Using it three times with three different keys was sort of the first thing that was done. But since then, there have been further developments from NIST in the form of something called the Advanced Encryption Standard that allows for more bits in the key and so on and so forth. So the point is that DES is an example of this kind of algorithm, and the way it works is it does a combination of permuting and masking things multiple times to take what starts out as a 64-bit input into a 64-bit output, and changing one bit up there will on average change half of the bits down here, which is essentially definition of random. Or one character, I shouldn't say definition of random, one characteristic of essentially being random. So those permutations and functional combinations sort of scramble things. Way more difficult to break than a simple substitution cipher. AES replaced it, and now I think there's something called AES 256 that uses 256-bit keys. Not going to be able to do brute force attacks against 256-bit keys, as far as anybody knows. All right. Well, so the advantage of symmetric key encryption is that typically the algorithms are very fast on modern processors. a few microseconds to encrypt a few hundred bits of message. That's in fact, compared to the network overheads, the network delays, the encryption delays that we observe in our research are using symmetric key encryption are sort of in the noise as far as any concerns about how long it takes to do anything. They're just very fast. We had this problem of how to agree on a key if we've never met. And we talked about how that worked. So in the mid-1970s, something new happened. So cryptography had like I said, a 2,500 year history coming up to the 1970s. And in the mid-1970s, something totally astounding happened. Somebody came up with a fundamentally different way of thinking about cryptography. And what was fundamentally different was that the sender and the receiver would use different keys. And it would be impossible to figure out one from the other. And I mean, it's just totally mind-blowing how much of a departure this was from anything that had happened before. Once we have a separate key for sending and receiving, separate keys for sending and receiving, we can think about lots of clever things, such as if people want to send me messages, they can do so with a key that everybody knows, the so-called public key. As long as I keep the other key private, the decryption key private, nobody else can decrypt those messages. We'll see a little bit farther down the road that if we turn that around and say, I will keep the public key, I always keep the private key. If I send messages using the private key, then people who can decrypt those messages with the public key know, we'll talk about what that means, know that they came from me. And nobody else could have sent them. It's a form of digital signing. So this is what it enables. The other really interesting thing about the public key cryptography schemes that have been proposed so far relative to things like DES, AES, is that they do not work by sort of scrambling the bits of a message. A message is no longer thought of as a sequence of bits. Rather, it is thought of as a number on which we do mathematical operations, addition, subtraction, multiplication, exponentiation, those sorts of things. If you look at the DES, AES picture, that's not what's happening there. We're just sort of mangling the bits, right? We're shuffling them, we're combining them with the bits of the key, but we're doing it in a way that doesn't think of that as a number. What happened here was people said, what if the messages are numbers? And once the messages are numbers, then we can think about these so-called one-way functions on numbers that can be easily done. And we'll talk about that next time. Okay. Any questions? We're just sort of at the end here, but if there are questions, I would entertain one. No? All right. So we will go on next time and work through the public key cryptography stuff. Thank you.